Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind, two crickets in a thorn tree. I'm half of your hosts, Nicholas Larimer, joined, as ever, by the other half of your hosts.
Gabriel Krauser. Do-do-do.
And today we've got a bit of a mishmash of an episode planned. We'll see where it actually takes us. But anyway, Gabriel just wanted to say a couple of things first off about the elections, which he's been talking about ad nauseum, and it's going to go mad if we talk too much about it. So, Gabriel, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so just for a moment, and to remind long-standing listeners, the two crickets metaphor before we were told and realized that this is the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind, the side of Mars, we used to say, we'll talk about anything as long as it's not South Africa. Because we would often end up doing the show at the end of the week, and we would discuss international affairs that we couldn't cover quickly in the other more sort of hard-hitting news bulletin type things that we did, and that Nick hosts very well on the Daily French Show. And that here we could just be a bit of expansive and kind of think about what matters in the world around us, because one of the problems with South Africa is that sometimes people can get into a bit of a gloomy isolationist vibe. And it's an interesting world out there. And if you want bad news, there's lots of bad news out there in the world.
yeah, we're not the only place that got problems.
So that is what we want to do this week. If you want to see more substantial, you know, tales on the election, please check out the Save the Vote project that I've been heading up. But basically the Constitutional Court, did one very important thing, which is it found that Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma's proclamation was irrational. That's a direct quote. So that's in August 3rd when she said, okay, we're going to have an election on October 27th. And everyone went along with it. And the IRR was like, this is voter suppression. This is election sabotage. This is irrational. This is unconstitutional. We were a lone voice in the darkness. And we are vindicated. So, I am vindicated. I am selfish. I am wrong. And other people were like, no, you can't really mean irrational. They must be exaggerating. Nah, we meant irrational. It was irrational. Fabulous. Okay. So that's good, because the two biggest problems were postponing the election to 2022. If IEC had gotten away with doing that, there's no reason it couldn't keep postponing it. We don't know what COVID's going to do. Basically, its argument is until everyone's vaccinated, we can keep postponing. So that would have just put desperate voters who want to change in a tricky position. That's unjustifiable. So we won that. We were part of the team that won that. The postponement was denied. The constitution was upheld. Dlamini Zuma's proclamation was rendered null and void and irrational. So that was another good win. And then on some legal technicalities, the Concord agreed with us. We made five arguments to the Concord in the second round, which was about the candidate nominations. Can you reopen the list so the ANC can get back on there and whoever else also wants to? Freedom Front Plus also wanted it. COPE also wanted it. Lots of parties wanted it. Obviously, the ANC was the big deal because it was missing completely, basically, from 13 municipalities where it currently has a majority. That's 13 out of almost 300 in the country. So there we said to the court, look, if the IEC can do this, it can't be because your order said it can do anything that's reasonably necessary to reopen the voter registration. And many people criticized us, including some friends of the IRR. But we were right. The court agreed. We also said that you can't call this a postponement. One of the parts of the Municipal Electoral Act, the relevant law, says if there's a postponement, the IEC can kind of change the timetable. But there was no postponement, because to have a postponement, you have to have an election, proclamation that's legitimate, and then a change of the date. And there was no legitimate proclamation in the first place. There was just a rubbish, a nonsense, whatever. We also said to the court that the IEC previously said it would be impossible to go through with this, to reopen candidate nominations. They said there's no way
they could ever do it.
And now they're saying they can do it, but they didn't give an explanation of what's changed. They just said now they're going to be Herculean, I quote, which is literally a mythological figure. So they're completely openly abandoning reason in the explanation of why they've changed their minds. We said to the court, this is no good. The court did not agree. But what the court said, which is interesting, is that it can't really rule in our favor. And that's because the matter had to be heard on the papers, which means there was no in-person There was no oral discussion in front of the court. When it's so hasty that the court has to decide just on the papers, then if one side says the other side is biased or acting badly or untrustworthy, and the other side denies it, unless it's completely obviously mad, unless there is no ways at all that it's telling the truth, you've got to believe the side that's denying. It's just a burden of proof thing when you're dealing with a court case on the paper. So we said you can't trust these guys. They said, look, we're not going to say you're wrong, but we are going to say we can't really agree with you given the way this trial's happened. And the fifth thing we said was that the IEC – the fifth thing we said is, look, if you do this, it'll be unfree and it'll be unfair. And the court says that might also be true. So one of the scenarios to just keep on your windowsill is that the election goes forward, that we're spared the situation in those municipalities where the ANC has a majority currently, but where it missed the original deadline. We spared the eventuality if they had not been allowed to re-register their candidates. If in those 13 municipalities, people had to go vote, but there was no ANC on the box, on the ballot, there might very well have been burning and toy-toying and very dangerous, terrible things. That's not going to happen because the ANC will be on the ballot box everywhere. But after the election, parties can come forward to the court, the electoral court, and climb to the Supreme Court of Appeal, maybe to the Constitutional Court, and say, look, this thing was not free and not fair. So you've got to disqualify all the ANC candidates in those municipalities. That can happen. The Concord explicitly left that option open. And I'm not saying it's right, but from a kind of perspective, you can see how that's almost the best of all worlds. So on all of that, the court either explicitly agreed with us or said, look, we cannot disagree with you, but we can't go forward on what you're saying. We can't say that this is unfree and unfair because the IEC's got the power to determine that. And we can't say that they're lying because the format of the trial doesn't allow us to do it. So like two full agreements and two semi-agreements and then one disagreement. And that's the last point, which is that we read the Municipal Electoral Act to say the IEC can never change a deadline that's already passed. So looking forward, if the deadline is tomorrow for anything, for the vote, for the candidate registration, nominations, for any part of the process, it can push that deadline forward today if it's a tomorrow deadline. But once the deadline was yesterday, it can't do that. Deadlines that have passed, as time passes, are like a guillotine falls that stops the IEC from reaching back in time and changing what's already happened. Now, one way to see why that must be so, like, imagine the election happens, and then after the fact, the IEC is like, nah, we didn't like that. Let's do another one. That couldn't possibly be free and fair or something within its powers.
Maybe it could go
to court and say there's like been a national disaster. Can you give us a special allowance? But it couldn't, of its own discretion, just say, taxi-backsies, that election was not legit. Let's do it again. And we think that a particular section blocks the IEC from doing that, that this is not a structural argument. There could also be a structural argument, but we thought the law blocked it. The court disagreed with us. And so basically it's established the precedent where it's explicitly said the IEC can change deadlines before and after the fact. And that puts us in a scary place because the IEC is not super trustworthy at the moment. But anyway, we respect the court's thing. We're going to have to think about it. There's no way to overturn it. Maybe, and I don't want to second guess what its motivations were. In fact, I am happy to say that its motivations were not to save the ANC. There's just nothing about the court's behavior that makes me think that. I don't think the court's on the ANC side in that sense. But I do think that obviously we disagree with what the court ruled.
Yeah, if the court was on the ANC side, they wouldn't have, they would have moved the election louder to move the election.
Exactly.
Right. Because it's clear from, you can check out the Daily Fringe show from today, the 20th of September. We just talked a little bit about, Gabriel and I were on that today, about how the ANC is really not in a good place at the moment. They would much prefer to have the election sometime in the future when they can get their ducks in the row. Some of our colleagues have been talking about how, like, they've been putting up 2019 election posters this time around, which is amazing. Not a good sign. It's not a good sign. All right, are you finished with saving democracy.
I'm totally done. That was 10 minutes, okay. And that's a lot more than I would hope for it to be.
Okay, cool. All right, well, we were kind of just sort of do a mishmash of all the weird and wonderful goings on in geopolitics at the moment, because my thesis is that as American power has retreated from the world, the B-level players, that's basically everyone who isn't China or America, is kind of stepping in to see what they can take, what they can do, and making plans, assuming that no one from the outside is necessarily going to intervene. So, you know, over the last while, we've seen Israel bombing Iran in Syria. We've seen Russia and Turkey at each other's throats. We've seen, of course...
Take a step back. How does Israel bomb Iran in Syria?
Iran has soldiers supporting the Syrian regime, mostly militias who are sort of kind of aligned with Iran or not. And also, in some cases, explicitly, their troops are there supporting Bashar al-Assad. And the Israelis have, quite often actually, I think they do it a couple of times a year at least, they do airstrikes on those troops. So Israel and Iran are pretty much at war. They just haven't declared it. And they're not, you know, invading each other's territory, but they are attacking each other quite explicitly. So it's, you know, it's a weird,
okay, no,
it's a
I hear
weird
you.
Kind
I,
of way
I
that modern war...
No,
works,
there's
right?
a lot of proxy. There's a lot of proxy. So you were going through a list of the sort of B-team guys that are stepping up.
India and Pakistan are competing for influence over Central Asia, and that's all been shaken up now because Afghanistan has fallen back into the Pakistani camp when it was kind of in the Indian camp. And of course, China is fighting with all of its neighbors, pretty much, except China's only friends are Myanmar and North Korea, and sometimes Russia, sometimes. Everyone else is either scared of it or doesn't like it.
Right.
Also, Laos might also be a Chinese ally. I don't really know anything about Laos, so maybe it is.
Yeah, Mongolia is sometimes kind of...
Yeah, Mongolia prefers Russia, though, because Mongolia has had a... much worse history being under Chinese domination than it has under Russian domination.
Being one of those countries, hey?
Yeah, well, you know, the tables need to be turned, right? Remember, Mongolia conquered both Russia and China at one point.
Yes. So, the worm does turn.
So let's talk about just get one thing out of the way, and that is, I think, the last thing to be said about the total shambles of the American withdrawal from Afghanistan, which we did a whole episode on. But after the terrorist attack by ISIS Khorasan Division, I think is their name, on American troops and refugees at the airport in Afghanistan as the Americans were pulling people out, the Biden administration said, no, you see, we're going to show how we're going to deal with counterterrorism in the future by doing a drone strike on a ISIS K commander, and so they claimed victory and they had killed someone in this drone strike who they said was a senior leader.
The top general called the drone strike righteous.
Yes. And I think it was either yesterday or the day before, or it might have been on Friday actually, the Pentagon said, about that, actually, we've looked over it again. We think we might have made a bit of an oopsie. And instead of killing an ISIS commander, we killed 7 children.
10 people, 7 children, and 0 ISIS.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why people were saying that the Americans should stay in Afghanistan is because it allowed them to do on-the-ground intelligence. Either the Afghan government would give them intelligence about what was going on, which would make their drone strikes far more accurate, or they'd be able to send out special forces scouts to like check out the environment and see, okay, that's an Al-Qaeda camp over there, that's a Taliban camp there, that's an ISIS camp there, and feed that information back to the Air Force, which then would do more accurate drone strikes. And with the withdrawal, they no longer could do that. So they took a shot in the dark, apparently, and they ended up killing a bunch of children. And it's actually, you know, not that common that, I mean, sometimes American drone strikes have killed civilians and completely missed terrorist targets before. I know that there was a drone strike in Yemen, I think it was a year or two ago, which killed I think it hit a wedding. And there've been a couple as well in Pakistan that have, by accident hit civilians. But generally speaking, they have tended to be more accurate than not. As we remember, of course, the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani was killed by an American drone strike, which was incredibly pinpoint decisive. I think it blew up basically two cars and that was it. So
it's pretty terrible. I do think there is a mixed record in terms of on the ground performance as well. I was this weekend, I watched a movie called The Battle of Haditha, which I might as well sort of recommend halfway through the show here. And this was Haditha is a city in Iraq. I watched the movie because one of my sort of university buddies became a war reporter in Syria, and I remember him bringing. Well, at the time, I kind of just followed the Iraq and the Afghanistan war kind of more closely because I knew some people who were running over landmines and stuff like that, and I was very impressed. And it was an important kind of thing. Anyway. The city of Haditha is in Iraq. It's on a dam, famously described as the kind of place where people would go for their honeymoon. So you kind of need to explain that because Iraq is a pretty bleak desert. But even there are kind of nicer places and less nice places.
It's two nice rivers and then the rest is kind of bleak desert and horrid hills.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm feeling very ungenerous, the Northwest also makes me think of this way. They're beautiful places in the Northwest, but.
But the Northwest is the worst province, but that's for another day.
Okay. So it does have the most. Anyway. So Haditha was like nice town, besieged by the Americans. Their occupation was one of the least popular occupations there. Sort of spot polls done by journalists seem to indicate 80% of Iraqis were totally against them being there years into the occupation, whereas in most of the places it was like 50-50 or something like that. And dudes were crazy. Soldiers were not being properly trained. They weren't properly disciplined, sort of very macho and hanging their asses out of the Humvees, just not professional. And they ended up killing sort of – there were lots of – The soldiers were at risk of being bombed while driving from what we would call landmines, but Americans called like improvised
explosive devices, IEDs.
IEDs.
Which are the way that most American soldiers have been killed in the last 10 years.
Yeah. And there's kind of something ridiculously embarrassing about the fact that the American soldiers still drive around in Humvees that are flat bottomed when the Nats, who, you know, had a terrible, terrible system, also figured out that if you're going to do a lot of occupation patrol, you should have a V-shaped bottom Casper, because it's much harder to blow that thing up from underneath. It deflects the explosions. And that's why the Israelis use a V-shaped bottom and so on.
It's funny you say that. Where do you think South Africa sold most of its Caspers to in the last 20 years?
Who?
The Iraqi government. They're one of the countries in the world, apart from South Africa, that operates the Casper.
That's buying from Denel. So anyway, I must on a very side note, there was a Casper that was bought by an artist and beaded up, covered the whole Casper with beads, took thousands and thousands of hours, and it is so beautiful. It was exhibited at the Turbine Hall Art Fair a couple of years ago in Joburg. And in Cape Town. Anyway, so, you know, terrible things can be recycled is the point, even from terrible regimes. Americans are instead driving around in Humvees. Car gets blown up. Soldier dies. Another two badly injured. And then other American soldiers just go kill 20 people eventually, mostly children. But this is like breaking into people's houses and just spraying bullets at everyone. And it was investigated by the military, and there was lots of independent reports at the time. I remember reading into it quite deeply, and it just did seem like, in part, it seemed like Israeli propaganda. you know, American soldiers are urinating on Iraqi prisoners of war and they're shooting children. And look at this little girl with one eyeball who's the only survivor in her family. Her granny and her five brothers and sisters were all killed. This sounds too terrible to be true. But I don't know. As far as the investigations go, as far as my reading goes, it was all true. So sometimes ground action was terrible. The flip side of it is that the Americans had seemed to be learning. They do seem to have learned. You know, if you look at combatant deaths, if you look at U.S. soldier deaths, if you look at the sort of relevant civilian deaths, they do seem to have learned some lessons in the occupation. And now they're playing a different ball game, and it started just about as badly as it possible good, as it possibly could, with effectively, you know, in some sense, the murder, certainly the negligent killing of seven children. So this is very bleak, and I suppose we've gone into this in some detail to caution against, you know, how does one react to that? Well, one response is, you see, this vindicates it. This shows that Biden was right, that Trump was right, that America's got to get out of there because it actually doesn't know what it's doing. And the only problem is that it's still there with its drones. It really needs to get out of there all of the way and just let Iraq be run by Iraqis. And that's an interesting idea, and I think very smart people kind of think that way. And I also think it's wrong. I think that's the wrong lesson to learn from this. And I do worry that this sets a kind of precedent for worse to
come. I will say the last 2-3 months have, shall we say, quite strengthened the argument the Americans don't really know what they're doing.
Exactly. There is a expertise gap. There's a knowledge gap in the American elite that is shocking.
Incredible. Yeah. So there's that. Let us talk. Oh, just on a side note, I went to look it up and there doesn't seem to be figures easily accessible online as to how many Iraq operates of the Casper. But the Indian Army actually uses almost as many as the South African Army.
Yes, I was going to say that I know it's not the only.
And the Americans use 68 of them, which is much fewer than South Africa. But they do have a couple kicking around, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, okay. But as a segue, in terms of military vehicles, fun fact, the Taliban now has more armored personnel carriers than most other armies, including for sure Australia, and I think also including France.
Right. And which
brings us to.
Yeah. So those who are following the news closely may know that the Australians, the British, and the Americans decided to do a special deal where they were going to sell the Australians a bunch of nuclear subs. So these subs are not armed with nuclear weapons. They're just powered by nuclear reactors. So they have these quite small, very high-powered nuclear reactors loaded into the submarine, and then this means that basically the submarine doesn't run out of fuel for literally years. Unlike a diesel sub where, you know, you have to refill every couple of weeks or months or something.
Yeah, and to clarify something that we said on the Daily Friend show, so generally, you know, on a very relaxed schedule, they might dock every 2 months to keep lots of fresh food going through the sailors' bellies.
Right, and get them out of the thing so they don't go crazy, which is another problem.
They can easily go 6 months. And in intense combat situations, they will need to collect stock every 6 months, but they don't necessarily need to go to harbor. So a little bit like how airplanes can refuel from a ship
or something. Yeah. So these submarines, basically, you can just send them out of the ocean. No one can have any idea where they are, and they can just sit around lurking, watching, spying, and possibly waiting in ambush for other ships. So they are very, very scary to a country with a lot of warships that might be vulnerable to attack.
It puts a question mark behind every asset you have on the ocean top.
Exactly. Particularly if you were a country, for example, like the People's Republic of China, and you wanted to invade another country, for example, the Republic of China, aka Taiwan, having a bunch of nuclear-powered Australian subs sitting in the channel between those two might make that whole proposition quite a lot more dicey.
Yeah. So that's why the move kind of makes sense. But right. The big news story of the week is that France is very upset about this yes. new alliance between the UK and the US and Australia.
So France had a pre-existing arms deal with Australia where they were selling them these quite high-tech but like expensive subs that they had to
diesel
drive all the way back. Yeah, they had to drive them all the way back to France to be like outfitted or repaired or pick them up and things like that. I mean, they, you know, so that, it was a bit of a schlep. The French have a pretty good arms industry and are quite aggressive in pushing for it.
We should know this as South Africans because we bought a French submarine that was docked in Simonstown. And
well, Jacob Zuma is facing corruption charges related to a deal with an arms company from which country, Gabriel?
Yeah. And do you remember that time that the submarine allegedly, I mean, this was, but anyway, it had an incident where it was damaged and then needed to get repaired. And when asked what the cause of the damage was, one of the relevant parties said that it misidentified a shark off the coast and so began evasive maneuvers and so grazed the bottom against a rock while it was trying to flee the shark.
Scratched
the bottom and had to go get it fixed.
I can't remember which minister it was. It was either the Minister of Defense or the Deputy Minister of Defense or Communications or something. Can't remember who it was. A couple of years ago said that we needed submarines to protect South Africa from sharks.
Well, this is why. So it was around then, and then France told me the story about when the... Anyway, it's terrible. It's very terrible. We have problems. That's all you can say. Yes. We've got problems. Australia also has problems, not the same problems.
Australia is very worried about China's growing naval and military power in East Asia to the extent that they've been willing to, jeopardize their extensive trade relations with China in order to kind of bolster their defense against the Chinese Navy, which is exactly what this was. And China was very upset about this deal. Not as upset as the French, apparently, though, because France withdrew its ambassador from the United States in protest over this, saying that they had been lied to and they'd been cut out of this deal, and it was the greatest betrayal in all of human history. I'm exaggerating, but that was the gist of the sentiment.
But it is their withdrawal of their ambassadors to the US and to Australia. They haven't done anything like that since I read somewhere that they hadn't done anything like that since World War II.
Yeah, so I mean, China is the country that this arms deal was literally, targeting. These subs are designed to shoot Chinese warships, and they didn't withdraw their ambassador.
Yes, so the French have reacted more sternly than the Chinese to the Australians cancelling the diesel submarine contract and taking up a nuclear submarine contract. So I don't know, Nick. Shall I? I mean, I know you think this is silly from the French. And I'm sorry to give your game away. And I think many people will think it's silly.
Anyone who's listened to this podcast will be surprised by this.
but let me briefly try and make the case for something that's interesting about France. France, since World War II, has been the most opposed. In a way, it's had a very confused and confusing geopolitics.
Can I just interject here? There's this kind of weird symmetry that emerged in the UN Security Council at the end of the Second World War, right? So it ended up being by the mid 70s that the five powers on the Security Council were two communists, that being China and Russia, or the Soviet Union at that time, the United Kingdom, the US, and one of the reasons the Soviets were hesitant to join us in the beginning was because they said, "Ah, there's going to be three democracies and only two of us, only two sort of non-first world countries," and this upset them greatly. Until they realized that the French were A little bit of a wild card.
Certainly a wild card.
Ever since.
Yes.
In that France is never on anyone's team except France.
And so I think that that is partly an upshot, and many people believe this. Many wise old analysts take the line that France has a very potent legacy, that it was the superpower of Europe 200 years ago.
But it was a martial powerhouse that dominated all of its neighbors.
Yeah.
For a very long time.
That this ends really in the Franco-Prussian War in the 1870s, 1879. And that it's not only dominant, it also has a kind of moral higher ground. It sort of makes this argument for republican democracy after the French Revolution. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Okay. So, you know, France in the 19th century, sometimes it thinks it's the cleverest because it's a republic. Sometimes it thinks it's the cleverest because it experimented with this democracy thing and then reverted back to monarchism. And it was like, you know, only the truly wise experiment in their youth with debauchery, but then grow into discipline and authoritarianism. Anyway, so it always had a story to tell about why it was the best. When it did lose its military power, it became culturally the most influential, I think, per capita kind of spot in the world. You know, Paris is the birthplace of so much of the art that influences Europe, Russia, China, Japan, America. And
the diplomatic language of Europe for a couple of centuries, through Europe's heyday, for a lot of it was French.
Lingua franca, all of this kind of stuff. So France has this reason to think of itself.
There's an enormous amount of national self-confidence.
Yes. Okay. So there are problems with that. The only people I've ever met when I was in America, the only people, like New Yorkers would often say New York is kind of the best city in the world. And then you'd say, do you really think that? Have you been everywhere? They'd say, of course not. It's just the best place I've ever lived. But Parisians, and I met several, said, no, this is the best. Paris is the best city in the world. But what about the place you haven't been? Of course, I have not been everywhere, but I know Paris is simply the best city in the world. Are you joking? Why would I joke about such a thing? Of course, there are some things that are better than other things, and Paris is simply the best in the world. If you do not accept this, I suggest that you undertake some psychological analysis. You are oppressed, and so on. Anyway, this was told to me unironically several times. That's one of the problems. One of the good things is that France has a very serious and I think quite healthy track record of arguing that we must be in one of two worlds. Either America gets to be the world's sheriff, but that takes place under an international system of rules and regulations that really do function court-like and law-like, and proper international bodies can be depended upon to stop and check it when that's appropriate. Or if America's not going to play by the rules, but it's going to be the most dominant power, then America must be checked. That you can't be in this world where America doesn't play by the rules, but it does get away with whatever it wants to do. And this is part of the reason that France thinks it's so important to build the EU. And amongst our colleagues, a lot of people are terrible EU skeptics, and with so much good reason. But the first argument for the EU is that it's to stop the Holocaust from happening again. And in a sense, its capital should be in Auschwitz, as the Booker Prize winner said. But the second purpose of the EU in the Cold War, from France's perspective, is to establish a power that can truly rival the other superpowers, and so check America in the event that America stops playing by the rules, which, I mean, we just talked about this drone strike. In the broader scheme of things, that tragedy might seem like a speck of dust, but if you add up all of the terrible mistakes that America's made, I think that one does see the some reason to be sympathetic to the French argument. And what France kind of likes the least, in a way, is bilateral or trilateral agreements, partly because of the social sense that, like, if you are having a party with three people, what about the fourth person? Why you're not doing this? Partly, but largely and much more seriously, because France was in a way the most let down by bilateral and trilateral agreements in the build-up to World War II. France had an agreement with Italy that in the case of German military aggression, Italy and France would fight together against the Germans. France had kind of the closest relationships in the 1930s with the USSR. Obviously, the fascists in Italy and Germany were like, the USSR is terrible. They are terrible. And France was like, no, we can kind of work with them. And Léon Blum was the socialist leader of France when World War II starts. You know, they had some very simpatico ideas. The French ultra left was very strong. So they had the makings of deals with the USSR to halt German expansionary aggression. They had wonderful agreements with the United Kingdom. And the UK does, of course, intervene in Poland. The UK and France should have stepped in earlier, and France has a lot to answer for. Intervening in the Sudetenland and the Rhineland. So I'm not trying to say that France was an innocent victim, but it had agreements with USSR, UK, Italy, all of the major powers involved. And all of those agreements, to a very significant extent, were broken, to such an extent that Paris was taken long before there was any real pushback against the Nazis, or any pushback that had a hope of really holding them back. So France has drawn a lesson, a deep lesson, as deep in a sense as the lesson that it drew from being so dominant. It's drawn a lesson that these bilateral, trilateral treaties aren't to be trusted, that what is to be trusted is a permanent thing like the UN, where amazingly it has a permanent seat, even though it's like quite small in a lot of ways, and the EU, where it has, you know, this is a permanent club. This is not just a bilateral or trilateral treaty. And, of course, Francophone Afrique and beyond, where France plays sort of colonial mothership, perhaps benevolently, yes. Perhaps.
I think benevolently and malevolently in sort of fairly equal measure. Can I give a slightly alternative? So I guess So I think the problem with the French is that they have this desire, even though they are a free country and they are part of the free world in a very real way, they have this desire to kind of stick to the sort of realist school of the 1900s, the 1800s very, very strictly, right? They always are very much French interests above all else, even if this means damage to their sort of ideological bedfellows. And in a world, I think, where, while of course, you know, realist geopolitical concerns are still very much a very real thing, you can take it too far. And this is a good example of that. This deal with the Australians. The fact that they're so upset, because they're going to lose out on revenue here. But as for that Second World War history, I mean, the French played and you did say this, but I just want to emphasize the point that French did really play a very unhelpful role in the lead up to the Second World War.
Unhelpful.
One of the reasons that Poland collapses so quickly, it's not just because the Polish army is outmatched by the Germans, they are, but they aren't able to mobilize their army because the French tell them, no, you're not allowed to mobilize, even though the German troops are all on your border, because that might provoke the Germans. Right up to the end of the Second World War, the French kind of don't really push the Belgians that hard, and so they can't send troops into Belgium until the Germans invade. The French, of course, you know, at the point I'm trying to make about realism and ideology, the French were pursuing a sort of slightly realist vision, but I guess also a sort of an ideological one, right? Because the socialists were in power in France, are saying, no, we can be nice to the Soviets and get them to contain Germany, just like in the good old days, right? Because the geopolitics, they thought, I think, was similar, right? The Germans are the threat and the Russians will ally with us, as they did in World War I. And it came back to bite them, because Stalin realized that he could make lots of great deals with Hitler, although they didn't turn out to be such great deals, in exchange for siding with the Germans. And the entire French war plan was built on this idea that, you know, Germany would be blocked by Russia from the other side. And when it didn't happen, they found themselves in a really sticky situation. And the last thing I want to say is the French, that French self-confidence, that incredible pride, really hurt them in the Second World War. And I think in part led to their, the bitterness that they would later feel, which is that right as France was collapsing, right, the British came to them and said, what if to prevent your government sort of falling over, we form a British and French union? So we will temporarily unite our two countries together. The French government will be able to operate entirely from London, and the French Navy will still remain under your control, but you won't drop out of the war, basically. And the French president and the queen will share control of, or they will both be the head of state, right? The British queen. And the French said no. And as a direct result of that, to prevent the French Navy falling into German hands, the British attacked the French Navy. Yeah. Well, they attacked it at rest in a surprise attack. In something the French are still bitter about, and they killed quite a few French sailors because the British basically sank their navy and stabbed them in the back from there.
To stop the Nazis from taking it, as, for example,
right,
Taliban
because,
did.
Because
you don't want to hand over
exactly
assets, material.
The British Navy said to the French Navy, come to Britain and continue the fight from there. And the French Navy said, no, we're not going to listen to you. We listen to our government, which at this stage had just turned into the collaborationist Vichy government.
Yeah, look, there's lots of problems that France had at the time. Also, I mean, there was quite a lot of anti-Semitism around, yeah. And so, like, it wasn't always so easy to go against Hitler.
France was a very divided country. I'm not saying that they had an easy hand to play. And, of course, it was the collapse of France was ultimately because the French generals were terrible and that people like de Gaulle were not very high-ranked. If de Gaulle had been leading the French, maybe they would have beaten the Germans in 1941 rather than, 1945. But yeah. I think the French desire to push back against the Anglo world is born of the fact that they have this self-confidence, and yet in the Second World War, it was brought low, right? For the first time in French history, at least since like sort of the Franco-Prussian War, France was really humiliated in an awful, awful way. And they
I semi-agree.
Claw back.
Their prestige.
Their place in the world, yeah.
Yeah, so I'll add that France was humiliated in World War I.
Not in the same way, because at least, they weren't conquered.
But in the hearts and minds of most people, the lesson from World War I was that this whole war thing is very terrible. You produce a lost generation of existential...
Right, which is why they behaved so in such a silly way in the lead-up to the Second World War.
Correct. And the bitterness of the Treaty of Versailles, making the Germans sign on, the most clear prestige nightmare in the history of the world, in a way, is the French insisting on the Germans taking all of the blame. Like, this is just about words. This is not about bodies or bullets or food or money. It's just words. We want you to say it was all your fault. No, so that we feel good and you feel crap.
And that was a concession because the British and Americans had sort of prevented them getting their original way. You can go and look up online a map of Europe as the French wanted to do with it in about 1916. And basically, one of the things they wanted to do was destroy Germany completely.
And this is where Nicholas completely agrees with France.
Yeah, because he thinks the French are stupid.
What I'm trying to say is, and that makes me very uncomfortable, is something, I've got a great affinity for Germany since I was there when I was 16. I kind of... it was the 2006 World Cup. There were sort of old Germans crying because they, for the first time, felt proud of their country ever in their lives because they always felt so humiliated. It had only unified in 1989, well, in the early 1990s.
You mean that unification? Yeah. The second unification.
Yes. So there is, so Germany's, I don't know, I've got it in a way. It makes me feel uncomfortable imagining destroying, not allowing Germany to exist, and instead having lots and lots and lots of little provinces, or lots of little countries that are all kind of the size of Belgium. Also, because Belgium is not that great.
Belgium's not that great.
So I think sometimes, like, Germany's a federal country. It's quite large, but there's a lot of devolved powers. The point is that France often has ideas that are like kind of contrary to everyone else's, and it's worth taking them seriously. And as much as Nicholas has pushed back very well, the one point that he hasn't managed to address is the American problem. America is the most powerful, most interesting country in the world. It's the most economically dynamic. It almost certainly has done the most to spread freedom in the last 200 years. But it goes unchecked. And America has been going insane.
Can I make a point in favor of the French on that last point, right? In the First World War, this is kind of what happens. The Americans, they're important for ending the war so decisively in favor of the Allies rather than something that's more a more murky settlement. I for my salt, still think the Allies would have won, but it was not a
–
It was not a sure thing.
Very tight. The stormtroopers were making gains in the close to Paris. The
1970s spring offensive, yeah.
Yeah, they finally get very close again, as they had been in 1914.
So the Americans play this way outsized role in the settlement of the First World War because they're the ones with the fresh reserve of men and the big guns and all the money, and they're coming right at the end, so they're not exhausted.
Yes.
Like everyone else is. And Woodrow Wilson, who is a malevolent menace upon American history and world history, as far as but we could fight about this another time.
I completely agree. It just makes me so embarrassed. I used to be so fond as Princeton president. Anyway, carry on. One does change one's mind now and then.
So he has all these grand plans for creating these sort of, I guess, kind of race-based democratic nation states all over Europe.
That's exactly what he wants.
Right. And he draws all these lines and he helps to enforce this world. And then he kind of falls out of power, right at the end of the war while they're doing the settlement. And in fact, his own government rejects the treaty, I believe, which he helped sign up. So the Americans do this thing, which they kind of are famous for doing. They push their way in. They set the rules. They throw their weight around, and then rather than sticking around to take part in the world they've created, they go, oh, this is too complicated and difficult, and they go home. and that's exactly what happens. And so from that perspective, I can understand why the French are perhaps a little bit skeptical of American power.
and it's – I do like to think in eras, in a sense. We were born – as the Cold War era ended, and we were in a new era called Pax Americana, you might as well call it that, because the world was unipolar. There was so clearly one nation that was way more dominant than all others in economic terms, in cultural influence terms, soft power terms, prestige terms, and in military, capacity. And America made some bad boo-boos. It allowed the fiscal rape of Russia, which meant that the Soviet Union, as it collapsed, became a kind of kleptocracy, rather than, an example, as Western Germany had been after World War II and other countries have been, that America has kind of defeated one way or another. Of how to do a kind of free market constitutional democracy type thing. Right. So that was a bad boo-boo, and it was basically, just guys turning a blind eye while dudes are making a quick buck. Not kind of terrible in a way. All the dark money that it created keeps coming back to harm lots of things. But, okay, maybe not the worst thing. And kind of you can imagine giving it a mulligan, right? Like first ball grace, as we used to say, as childhood cricket
players. I would say that also, the loss of the Vietnam War was like kind of almost set the template for how they would muck up things going forward.
Yeah. No, so it did. They kind of left, which was maybe the right thing to do, but they definitely did it in the wrong way for the wrong reasons. And with the wrong attitude to the South Vietnamese allies that they had. It would be one thing to leave and be like, we're so sorry, we are betraying our allies because we're stingy and we just don't have the money. Or we're so sorry, but we've become kind of pacifists. Instead, they were like, we're not really sorry. You shouldn't be fighting against communism and for capitalism. This is terrible. This was part of the cultural lesson that was learned.
They also had this problem where they couldn't decide if the South Vietnamese were a puppet government or an ally.
Yes.
So Kennedy, quite early on, and this is the point that really destabilized South Vietnam, there's a military dictator in South Vietnam, and Kennedy engineers, I think it's Kennedy? Yeah, I think it's Kennedy, engineers his removal by a sort of coup, because, you know, he just doesn't like him. He thinks that he's awful. And also he kept producing embarrassing sound bites. I think he said in an interview or something that he admired Hitler, something crazy like that. Anyway, after they got rid of that dictator who was, you know, technically
which,
on
who,
their
side, by the way, Kennedy admired. Kennedy totally admired Hitler.
Yeah, but Kennedy, Kennedy knew that you didn't say that to the 1960s media.
and he thought it in the 1930s, and he said it in his diary and in his letters.
But after they get rid of this guy, South Vietnam kind of is plagued by political infighting for the rest of its existence. Mm. And, you know, later when they try to turn it kind of into an ally, well, they've already caused so much chaos that, you know, the project requires a lot more investment, and then they're just not willing to give that because the public's against the war. And so, like I said, it's the blueprint for how to defeat America, one which the Americans psychologically have not been able to reckon with yet.
Okay, but so here's the thing, right? So, and the Pentagon Papers are a very important part of the disillusionment with trust in the American military. The American military says, we do this, we're going to win. Pentagon Papers reveal that they knew better than that, that they knew that it was going to be tougher than they were saying. And that breaks the faith as well. That makes sort of rational analytical arguments about like cost benefit. Like, look, if we leave, it's going to be this bad and it's going to cost us this much in the long run in terms of blood and treasure. And if we stay, it is terrible, but ultimately it's not as bad. That kind of fancy pants clever argument doesn't wash once the credibility is being eroded. What I'm suggesting is that, so if you just quickly run through, so they learn the wrong lessons from Vietnam. They screw up the transition of the Soviet Union into those countries that survive it or pick it up where the Soviet Union left off. They then get involved in the most heinous opportunistic ways in the Balkans. Clinton is basically ordering bombing attacks according to election timetables. That's not good. And that's in France. And France's line at the time is, you know, one of the arguments that France was making at the time, and I remember this because I was hanging out with French aristocrats, and they would sort of have copies of Le Monde lying around on their table, and I'd say, what does that mean? One of the arguments was like, look, we need the euro. We need to really strengthen Europe because America is Meshuggah. It's won the Cold War. It's now the only superpower there is, and it's not acting responsibly. What comes after that? 9/11, and then America invades Afghanistan. Okay. I think that was the right thing to do. It kind of gives up on chasing down Osama bin Laden. I think that's weak sauce. It gets confused about, I think it sets its ambitions too high, in Afghanistan. But be that as it may, I think that it was just to invade Afghanistan, just to occupy Afghanistan, and just to try and, reduce the sort of, cancer clot throwing of global terrorism that was coming out of the Taliban's occupied zones. But then it invades Iraq under false pretenses. And France is in a very strange position in the Iraqi war. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, but whereas the UK joins and Russia, is very friendly with the US, at the time, France is like, no, you guys can't do this. This is not on. You haven't gone through the UN. You haven't gone through NATO. And this is an inappropriate way to invade another country. You're abrogating the rules of the road, the international norms that kind of hold, the whole system together. And part of that is Bretton Woods. Part of that is IMF, World Bank kind of, standards about how trade deals can be struck so that you're not too punitive. Part of it is also about the rules of invasion and not invasion. And this is probably the most obvious, in my opinion, instance where America is acting crazy and is unchecked and there's nothing that anyone else can really do about it. Now America's left Afghanistan in the worst possible way. Biden says they're going to leave Iraq. They can't possibly do it as badly as they've done it in Afghanistan.
Never say never.
But then again, And so, you know, you've got to ask yourself, how much time do we spend talking about American politics? One of the reasons is that if they sneeze, the rest of the world gets a cold. Okay, that's literally true of Wuhan, but it's kind of always true of the U.S., fiscally, militarily, and so on.
Right. Just go look at the comment section on the Daily Friend where this has been posted, and you will see people referencing things that do with America, making reference to arguments from the U.S. It's not, and that's even on articles and things that are not about America specifically. And this is true for literally every news site in the country.
Yeah.
Find exactly the same thing.
And I think what's unusual about you, okay, maybe not that. I think for journalists, we are probably much more sympathetic to America than most South African journalists. I think that's fair to say.
You and I both have a deep personal affection for that country and its people for the most part.
Yeah. Correct. But I do think that unchecked power is inherently dangerous. And I get France's argument that if you have that this is just another step in the direction of the US being the captain of one club and the only other captain is Beijing. And that's kind of the worst of all worlds. It would rather have international clubs that can be proper rule enforcers rather than little alliances that are unreliable and that ultimately devolve the world back into realpolitik because there is no rule enforcement mechanism. Okay, so that all being said, I think – I don't know that I can support France's decision to cancel a trade deal with Australia.
Well, yeah, and so just as the sort of small amount of pushback – because I think you've made a reasonable argument there, but I think a small amount of pushback is that at least some of what the French are saying is simply cover for their brutally realist French first nationalistic.
Yeah. You guys are cancelling our money. We were going to make $65 billion.
Right.
We were going to be the captain of this little team.
Even in the other conflicts, I suspect that the French at least a little bit were kind of. The stuff you other talked about, like the Iraq war and stuff, we were thinking, you know, if the Americans can ignore the UN, then they can ignore us because we're such an important part of the UN.
Yes,
so they're doing it to protect their own interests. So, yeah, you know, that's the harsher interpretation. Anyway, I don't know how much, you know, we've only got 3 minutes left of our supposedly an hour show. Ha ha ha. do we want to say anything about Turkey?
Yeah. Let's just quickly say about Turkey.
It's related to
France. Yeah, it's so related.
So Turkey's been in an interesting position over the last couple of years, particularly under, I can't remember how to pronounce his first name, but Erdogan.
Yeah. I also don't know how to say his first name.
He's Erdogan got a complicated Turkish first name.
Recep. Anyway. I think it's a Recep.
Something like that. Anyway, Turkey has been in this complicated position. So Turkey's economy has been growing pretty nicely. It's a country with a pretty big population. It sits on this incredibly important trade network, as it has for literally, you know, its entire existence. And the previous empires that occupy that space have sat on that. The Bosphorus, although I don't know what it's called these days, the Sea of Marmara. Anyway, not particularly important. So it's got this interesting geostrategic position. It's a rising power in a lot of ways. But ever since Erdogan came into power, it's been playing a very funny diplomatic game. So Turkey was traditionally in favor very much of secularism, anti-communist, and pro-NATO.
Which, right? By the way, it gets the secularism directly from the French model. 100 years ago, they're like, these guys have got it right. We're going to play their music at our military parades, and we're going to be super secular like the French. Because that's how you deal with this Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, you know, Shiite, Sunni, all those problems. Just make it go. Okay, sorry, carry on.
Right. So the Turks start to move away from some of these positions under Erdogan, right? Particularly after there's a coup attempt against Erdogan, which Erdogan claims the Americans backed, but I don't really know how much evidence there is to support that. They may have backed it in a sort of very loose rhetorical sense, but they certainly didn't, I don't think, back it with any kind of resources. But that's neither here nor there. After that, they kind of start to play this game where they start intervening in all sorts of conflicts around the Middle East, around their area. So in Syria, the Americans really aren't sure who to support because the Syrian civil war is so complicated, but they end up essentially backing the Islamist rebels fighting Bashar al-Assad. The Islamists tend to be Sunnis, who are the majority of Syria's population, and Bashar is an Alawite, which is sort of like a Shiite Muslim, but not quite. They're like their own thing. It's really complicated to explain, but that's also neither here nor there. And they also get involved in Libya, where they start backing the internationally recognized government over the government that's based in Benghazi. Because Libya, of course, has a civil war when Muammar Gaddafi is thrown out. And the Islamists almost take over the country, but they're defeated by a coalition of I wouldn't call them secular forces, but sort of more military-focused forces, which then end up being divided into a sort of a pro-Russian and a pro-Turkish camp. And so Turkey is involved there. And in fact, the pro-Russian side, who are not entirely pro-Russian, they also have some association with the U.S., almost win that civil war in Libya, but then the Turks sent soldiers and intervene. Turkey also has been helping its ally, Azerbaijan, who are also a Turkic people, so they have a sort of cultural, political, pan-Turco relationship that goes back a long way.
A kind of race vibe, basically.
Yeah, it's a kind of race vibe thing. To fight their enemy, Armenia. They also, of course, have been squabbling.
Armenia's never had it easy, let me tell you.
No, Armenia is in one of the worst geopolitical positions, and it hasn't just been in the worst geopolitical position in the 20th century or the 21st century. It's been in the worst position for like 1,000 years.
The centuries, longer, if you arguably. Can name the century, yeah, I think it's been the worst in that century.
It used to be a sort of buffer zone kicking around place between Persia and ancient Rome. That's how long Armenia's been bullied by its neighbors for.
So Turkey. There's a story about Emperor Claudius trying to make friends with an Armenian king to get him to help put down a rebellion sort of in kind of what we would now call Israel, Syria. And then it doesn't work out. And then the one king kills the other king, and then the Armenians get betrayed, and then they just get crushed again by the Romans. And then it's just always been.
Right. It's a mess. It's a terrible part of the world.
Turkey's. And that's kind of the most recent point, right, of interest here.
Right. And the Turks have also been continuing to fight their enemies in the east who are Kurdish. The Kurds have a very complicated situation where there's lots of different factions of Kurds. They all agree they want their own state, but some of them are very, very old-fashioned Marxist, communist, Stalinist. Some of them are far more sort of nationalistic-y. Some of them are more keen on a kind of semi-secular democracy, and the Turks don't distinguish. They just paint all of them as radical terrorists who need to be destroyed, the same as ISIS.
Yeah, and we talked about this because the Americans were allies to some of the Kurds, and then Trump turned his back on them, and that was something that really irritated both of us. It was a terrible betrayal, and I think foreshadowed the betrayal of the Afghan allies that we've seen now.
Exactly. Recently, Turkey seems to have been put. It also used to be allies with Israel, right? It was the secular Muslim power that was allied with the Jewish state against the less secular Arab powers. And Turkey, you know, it's got a similar to the French problem that has this vision of itself as, you know, it used to dominate the Middle East, and it's since fallen low, and it now wants to kind of reclaim its position of preeminence in the Middle East, but it's kind of been stretching itself, I think, a bit thin. So the Turks have managed to do a lot. They've actually got a pretty good army with pretty good NATO tech. However, they've managed to isolate and annoy the Americans. Erdogan had a relatively close personal relationship with Trump, but the American government, starting, I think, before the Trump administration, has increasingly drifted away from Turkey and now views it far more in a far more hostile light, and there's even some people who say that Turkey should be kicked out of NATO. Turkey's been reigniting conflicts with its neighbor Greece, who it hates. The Turks and the Greeks hate each other in a way that few countries do. I mean, it is a very deep thing. The Turks have been backing this group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, which are basically, I guess you could call them Al-Qaeda light in Syria. And Turkey had been trying to get these guys to at least pretend to be moderates and not so keen on sort of being like Al-Qaeda light. And it hasn't really worked, partly because they broke out into massive celebrations upon the victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And now the Syrian government under Bashar al-Assad, backed by the Russians and the Iranians, has just launched an offensive. And it's putting a lot of pressure on that group. So Turkey looks like it might lose some of its foothold in Syria. Turkey also alienated itself from the West by buying a Russian air defense system and then proceeded to shoot down a Russian plane and fight with the Russians in Syria.
That was one of the weirdest things.
Yeah. Right. And fight with Russia's ally in Libya and fight with the Russians' ally in Armenia. So they're pretty sound relations.
And I think, just to dwell on that point briefly, Turkey and Russia, very similar countries. Technically democracies, easy to dismiss as not being democracies, but really they are democracies. That where the people have just generally elected someone that doesn't think of as being particularly democratic. That means that their foreign policy...
In Turkey than in Russia. Erdogan... There's more like free media institutions, for example, whereas Putin, I think, has a pretty strong grasp of a lot of Russian media and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. This is a relentless kind of – I think people have something like that may be true. Maybe it's not true. In any event, the point is that they are democracies, but that they're considered autocracies because their government's foreign policy – because their governments have such a strong majority – on the back of such a heavy-handed kind of nationalism that they can do a lot of militarily adventuristic stuff that in other countries, for example, America, you kind of do that kind of stuff and eventually you get punished by the peaceniks and the people who care about human rights. That is kind of, you know, it's just impossible to imagine either Turkey or Russia withdrawing from Afghanistan in the way that the Americans have for some kind of moral reason.
They'd only withdraw because it was too expensive.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. And they would say, this is terrible. We should be everywhere, but we're not there because we can't afford it. So we come back. And then like everyone else, they'd say, but this is actually, we're still there because, you know, we're everywhere. You know, then they'd talk a bunch of rubbish about how it defeats a victory. Anyway, the point is that, in the mid 2010s, when The Economist, for example, was, had turned against Russia to a degree that I think was not warranted by the facts, an unfortunate exaggeration of the problems in Russia, which are so great that you don't need to exaggerate them. One of the things that it really worried about was a Turco-Russo alliance. In terms of where they lie on the map, you can see the logic for why they should work together. Russia's worry has always been that it doesn't have access to a warm ocean 24/7. If it had a proper close best buddies relationship with Turkey, then it would achieve that interest. So it'd be really good for Russia. For Turkey, it'd be really good because Russia is a nuclear power.
There's one more way that tensions are starting to rise between the two. So Turkey has this old agreement over that choke point we were talking about at where Istanbul is. That was signed back in like 19 something. I think just after the foundation of Turkey. And it says that you can't give tolls to ships passing through them. They started to dig a canal around the other side of Istanbul, which will allow them, they'll basically treat as the expressway, and they will charge tolls for that one. And I think that the goal there is to slowly basically strangle out the give them a trigger finger on a gun pointed at the Russians' head.
Yes, yes. So they could have been the closest of allies. They're both hard realists, not particularly moral in their foreign policy. They're both adventurous. They both have hyper-nationalist
The Turks bought oil from ISIS. So then,
yeah. Yeah. And yet they, you know, then the Turks, they bought weapons from the Russians and then shot Russian weaponry down. So I think that, that's just a nice example of kind of the end of the line that one worries about with France. So France is in a kind of more civilized way, but that's partly because it's richer. And so it plays a different kind of game. When it's angry, it's like canceling a trade agreement. When Turkey's angry, it's buying oil.
And the peace sticks are stronger in France, I would say.
For sure. But what we're seeing is, you know, France punishing, allies, for what they think is bad behavior. And I think it's going to be fine. I think it's going to wash over. I think they'll teach the Australians a lesson. I think the Australians are going to be like, dude, if you really want us, you're going to have to give us nuclear submarine technology because that's really what we're looking for. And then maybe they'll go back. Let's see if that happens. I doubt it'll happen.
I see the Australian Prime Minister, I think while we were talking, basically just said, hey, we told you guys we had some problems with your submarine contract, and so you shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. So I think it's going to wash over. But you see the pattern, which is that if you do punish your allies one by one by one, if you act in a kind of arrogant fashion where maybe it's righteous, to use that American phrase, maybe it is kind of right case by case. If you don't do a little bit of what's ultimately an act of realism, friendship in the sense is pragmatic, right? It's not grounded in your best principles and morals. But a little bit of forgiving your friends and being like, okay, you've harmed our interests. We think you've been deceitful, but whatever. We're not going to make too much of a big deal out of it. If you don't do that now and again, you might find yourself in Turkey's position, which is like China's position in that it's kind of got hostile relations with all its neighbors. But it's in a much weaker position because it doesn't have the world's largest or second largest economy. And insofar as its economy has been very strong, it's been a strange kind of growth. A lot of construction growth, which leads us to the last point that we were going to discuss very briefly, which is I'm just going to touch on watch out for the Chinese housing market and debt market. Evergrande, a Chinese company that I think has about 1.92 million home loans on its books. Not really that much. I'm speaking very much under correction. It's lost 10% in its market share. Credit default swaps for Chinese sovereign loans and for some of these collateralized mortgages are spiking. This is the kind of thing that happened before the U.S. fiscal financial crisis. For my money, I don't think that's the same thing that's happening in China right now. It is worth considering that if China were to have a financial crisis, if its banking sector kind of failed because people had been gambling in the way that the Americans had, CEOs would definitely go to jail. Some of them might be shot, but for sure some would go to jail. That's interesting in part because the Supreme Court of the United States finally put the issue to bed of whether any Americans are going to go to jail for the deception, for in particular Goldman Sachs versus the Arkansas Teachers Union or retirement system. That case was just completed recently. I listened to the Supreme Court argument last week. It was terribly boring. And my conclusion basically is that you're very technical. Why did no one in Goldman Sachs go to jail? It's because the law writes a kind of script for how you can defraud your own customers, and Goldman Sachs stuck very carefully to that script. So I think the law's an ass, and it's crazy that they haven't adjusted the law. I think it'll be terribly embarrassing if China does have a bit of a financial system wobble, because they'll deal with it in a way that'll satisfy populists outside of China much more than America did. People will be like, look, you guys, you didn't let your banks, your big banks, your big lenders fail, big housing companies fail, but you did. You also have too big to fail, and we understand the logic of too big to fail. You've got to bail out, and that's what the Chinese will do. They'll print money. Maybe it creates a buy-in for Bitcoin. That's also why some people are excited about it, because Chinese people will then worry about inflation, whatever. Let's see. But if they're in that position, they'll be like, there's no too big to jail. We put some CEOs behind bars. And the Bernie Sanderites, of which I kind of was one, still am one to some extent, in this regard, in the U.S., will be delighted. And they'll be like, this once again vindicates the Chinese system. So I kind of, on two levels, hope
Bernie Sanders being in favor of a foreign authoritarian regime that oppresses its people is not new. This is a man who did a holiday in the Soviet Union.
The Soviet Union's a perfectly reasonable place to honeymoon.
Yeah, while praising it.
In the 1980s, it was doing a lot of interesting things.
Okay. Let's not.
The gulag was closed. They closed the gulag.
Not quite. Not quite. Like, only later. But anyway, let's not get stuck on, you know.
We're not going to get into that too much.
How you are far too soft with the Soviets.
These are half my family. but anyway, the point is, just the last indicator for China is their PMI, which is basically like, a strong indicator of what inventories are doing and what inventory managers are thinking about an economy that's dropped to like a negative indicator for the first time in quite a while in China. So China is, this is just surprising. I thought that they were doing really well through the pandemic. They are seeing some signs of weakness.
Right.
Who knows if they're, who knows what that brings.
So can I
too soon to read too much into it.
But my brief spin on this. So Gabriel knows an immense amount more about financial markets than I do. So take this from where it comes. But I wonder how much of this is China's sort of chickens coming home to roost. China struck this very careful balance between keeping the authoritarianism but allowing some free markets. And it was a very difficult line to walk. And in my understanding, China has veered far more into the authoritarian route of late. You've seen them arresting their CEOs and things. And that there's a possibility, and nowhere near a certainty, but a possibility, that what is going to happen here, because I think people have been warning about this debt bubble thing for a long time.
Yes.
In China, particularly around housing, because they have all these, you know, fancy projects that didn't have people in them. That the Chinese might have screwed themselves in a way similar to the West, but that they may reap a much worse harvest from it, even if they are, you know, arresting people and blaming someone for the disaster, that their system might suffer a lot of damage from this. We'll have to see, obviously, and that would make the world a very complicated and messy place. But I wouldn't be surprised if China, people talked about Japan in the 80s as being this inevitable superpower that's going to overtake the U.S., and then it hit a bit of an oopsie-doopsie in the 90s. And I wonder if China might go the same route. It's, like I said, nowhere near a certainty, but I think it's a possibility.
Yeah. I mean, my sense, I think we've always agreed that something like that has got to be bound to happen as long as human beings keep being the kinds of things that they have been, but that it might only happen after we die.
It's going to happen. It's just going to happen at some point.
Yeah. So if it is happening now, it's interesting. I feel very like I haven't even presented the data that I've read briefly very well now. I've been a little bit under the weather, but I think this is something to look at again. And hey, I mean, I think in two crickets we were talking about coronavirus in January 2020, which was way before the cool kids were doing it. So if Nicholas is right, we'll be able to claim the
prophecy business. The prophecy business, you know?
Well, one of the good things about these really long episodes is that we throw so many darts at the board.
Yes.
We have to hit the bullseye now.
Well, would it just be like the Americans to maintain their global hegemony just because the Chinese messed up, not because they were particularly good?
Yes. No, I think that is the... the own goal turns out to be the sort of decisive move of the 21st century. Anyway.
But anyway. Okay, we are long. So let's call it to a close. Any recommendations?
So I think Battle of Haditha is a good movie. It's well-sourced. You can read some reportage in the New York Times and New Yorker. It covers that and the Washington Post. I think when those papers were quite serious about doing good war reporting, if you're not into the movie, it's pretty grim. But if you want to get a vivid sense of how wrong things can go at a very personal, you know, like this is not like a bomb dropping on a city that destroys the whole city. This is like face to face kind of, war gone wrong. I think it's an interesting experience.
Ill-disciplined soldiers are never a good thing.
No. You really want professionals. You don't want bloody teenagers. I've got another recommendation, which is Goodbye Lenin. But I'm just gonna put that one out there for people who know it. And I'm gonna talk about it another time. It gutted me. It's so funny, and that's the first movie in quite a while to just wreck my emotional equilibrium.
So your thing about
in a good way, in a terrible way. Sorry.
This thing in Iraq, it reminded me of a thing I had watched on Iraq as well a while ago. It was a Vice News video on YouTube. It's called "Fighting the Islamic State with Iraq's Golden Division: The Road to Fallujah." Now it's out of date because it was recorded in 2014, and Iraq is in a much better place than it was then. But it's just it's a journalist who's traveling around with the Iraqi special forces, fighting ISIS in Mosul in northern Iraq. And it just gives you a sense of how brutal and rough that war is. But also that, you know, it isn't just the West that's fighting, groups like ISIS. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of the fighting and dying is done on the ground by locals. Just as in the Afghanistan war, most of the killing and dying in the last couple of years and overall has been done by Afghans.
Yeah.
You can see that in Iraq, a similar thing has been going on. Although, the guy he's traveling with, I'm not sure we say, let's just say that the incidents like you talked about that the Americans doing, that we would say is more the exception than the rule. In Iraq, these troops may behave in the other way. Videos of them torturing ISIS, suspected ISIS prisoners and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's a rough watch. Don't watch if you're squeamish or easily traumatized, but it is very insightful about how rough things are and also how modern war looks these days. There's a scene in the video where ISIS tries to kill the Iraqi commander there with, by flying a little drone and dropping a hand grenade on him. And it is remarkable, actually, how much drones have changed warfare. Yeah. Anyway.
Sure.
Cool. With that, we bid you adieu. We shall see you on the next episode and have a wonderful week. Keep the flag of liberty flying.
Grr, 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 grr.